panel today is to my left is the rookie, Justice Dana Womack. To my right is the next to the rookie, Justice Dabney Basil. And with all the turnover we've had, the fact that I am now in the middle and I'm already up to fourth in seniority on the court, I'm Wade Birdwell, and I'll be conducting this hearing. So if we will call the case, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
The court will now call in the interest of AFWJ, AJ, and AJ children. May it please the court, Mr. Brian Newman will argue for the appellate mother, Eddie, and Lindsay Newell will argue for the appellate father, Eddie, and Justice Spence will argue for the athlete, Texas Department of Family.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Newman. I represent MB in this matter. This case involves the automatic dismissal of a suit filed by the Department of Family and Protective Services. The legislature has given trial courts limited subject matter jurisdiction over suits filed by the department. That jurisdiction is limited in duration. A suit must be called to trial or otherwise extended prior to the Monday following the expiration of 1 year. MB prevails in this case for two reasons. First, the versions of sections 263, 401, and 402 applicable are the versions that became effective September 1st, 2017. Second, the trial court did not take any affirmative action to avoid the dismissal date. The trial court did not enter an order extending the dismissal date. The court did not call it to trial. And finally, there was no final order rendered or any other temporary order that would have extended it. To resolve the first issue, I think this court should look at two authorities. First, section 155001, subsection D, specifically going to the continuing and exclusive jurisdiction that a family court has. And there was no court of continuing and exclusive jurisdiction. There was a petition filed by the Office of the Attorney General in this case. It never resulted in a final order. The act of entering a final order is a necessary step to establishing a court of continuing exclusive jurisdiction. In the absence of a court of continuing exclusive jurisdiction, all subsequent filings are treated as original proceedings. What is clear here is the Office of the Attorney General in June of 2017 had filed their petition. The only order that I can recall them getting signed was a default temporary order. It was then later set for trial. No trial was conducted on that petition.
Do we know, are we correct in looking, inferring from the record, that the father initially, there wasn't a contest. It was a default temporary order with regard to paternity that was entered. But for some reason, there was not a final order with regard to the paternity action. And by the time he filed his counterclaim, he was admitting judicially that, in fact, he was the father. So is there anything in the record that would indicate that the trial court rendered a final judgment with regard to the paternity action?
There is nothing in the record that would indicate that there was a final order there. I do agree with the court that they did render a temporary default order, but never a final order in this case. In fact, it was set for a trial, I believe, the first week of May of 2018. In the intervening time period between that setting and from the time it was set to the actual setting, the Department of Family and Protective Services had filed their petition. I believe at that point the AG had considered it moot and not proceeded.
Okay.
Finally, I think the court should look at the plain language of 263-401. What is clear is that 263-401 says that these dismissal dates and the effective dates should be judged by petitions filed by the department. The Office of the Attorney General is a separate executive agency. And as such, when they file a petition, it should not have any impact on the law that applies when the department files their petition. What is also clear is the facts necessitating the removal and ultimately the petition going to trial in this case did not have any existence, in fact, prior to September 1st, 2017. Further, the appellee's argument seems to indicate that the filing of this petition is significant, but yet the appellee never addresses in their briefing how, if anything, it changes because the child AF was not part of the petition filed by the Attorney General. At the time of filing, the child AF was under the continuing exclusive jurisdiction of the 233rd Judicial District Court and later had to be transferred in or consolidated into the action pending in the 231st. Additionally, I would like to talk briefly about the actions taken by the trial court in this case. The petition was filed by the Department of Family and Protective Services on March 1st, 2018. Contemporaneously with that, the trial court entered its ex parte order, which removed the child from the parent's custody and named the department as the temporary managing conservator of the children. And as such, that began our 1 year and a Monday time clock. And so my math, and I think the math of every party involved, puts that dismissal date as March 4th, 2019.
Is there not something in the petition that I'm thinking that this may be a statutory requirement with regard to pleading, but does not the department have to, when it files its petition in this regard, demonstrate that there is no other court with continuing exclusive jurisdiction over the child who is made the subject of the petition?
Yes, that would be a standard pleading that's contained in their petition.
Okay, and in this particular pleading, there was a statement to what effect?
I would have to double check that, but I believe to the effect that there was no continuing court.
No other court.
Yes, and I want to be hesitant about that because I'm not 100% certain on it. Because typically when original proceedings are filed by the department, they vest with the 323rd Judicial District Court. That differed here. It was filed into an existing cause number. I think ultimately it should have been filed into the 233rd because there was a court of continuing exclusive jurisdiction with regard to the child AF. And so I think that was the court of continuing exclusive jurisdiction. The original petition should have been filed with regard to the other three children. Then under Rule 174, it should have been consolidated together. I think that would have been the proper procedural mechanism to get to this case.
Okay. Let's set the other children aside for right now, okay?
Yes.
And AF is the only child involved with regard to this, okay? But a termination suit is filed in the 233rd as opposed to in the 231st as opposed to the 233rd. Okay. Is there any impact with regard to that? Is there any argument that any judgment entered with regard to AF would be void because it has to have been filed originally and come through the court that had already had exclusive jurisdiction?
Yes, I believe Section 155.001 vests subject matter jurisdiction with the trial court that has continuing exclusive jurisdiction. The exclusivity of it would prevent the 231st from acting. Now, there may be some procedural mechanism where the judge of the 231st sits as the judge of the 233rd, but I don't think inherently filing into a different district court would solve that problem.
Does 155.001 prohibit a transfer like the transfer that occurred here?
It would not prohibit a transfer. There are provisions later in the code that do deal with that. I think you would have to adhere to both the requirements of Chapter 155 and additionally the rules of civil procedure. And so it would be a 45-day period prior to any hearing on it. But as far as a transfer would go, I think it would be problematic in the absence of an improper venue. I don't think there's any dispute that both of them would be a proper venue. They're both sitting in Tarrant County, Texas. And so the justification to transfer it would probably have to rely on something along the lines of Rule 18B, recusal. I can't see any other reason to transfer within county to a different district court to hear a case where a district court in the county has already obtained and maintained continuing exclusive jurisdiction.
My recollection, and it may be incorrect with regard to the record, is I thought I read that the transfer actually dealt with a different father. Was there a different father of AF as opposed to the other children?
There were, Judge. And
You go ahead and answer.
Yes. So there were two fathers before the court. The three children, WJ, AJ, and JJ, had the father that Ms. Newell represents. There was another father before the court, I believe IF. And IF, there was a paternity suit in the 233rd. Which established continuing exclusive jurisdiction with regard to his child in the 233rd Judicial District Court.
Okay. What was the nature? Was the nature of the 233rd action also a paternity?
I believe it was, Judge.
Okay. Had there been a final order entered in that case?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
and you have the same amount of time that you were given to begin with. Counsel, you'll get additional time because I took him over. Okay?
Your Honor, Justices, Mr. Newman, Mr. Spence, may it please the Court. My name is Lindsay Newell, and I represent W.J., the appellant before you, and the respondent father in the trial court below. As Mr. Newman pointed out, the question before you is whether this case automatically dismissed on March 4th, 2019. And the answer is yes, it did. And I'm asking that you set aside termination order entered by the court on March 26th, 2019, because that order is void, because the trial court lacked jurisdiction to sign that order. In reaching that conclusion, as Mr. Newman mentioned, we look at Texas Family Code 263-401A to determine when our dismissal date is. And here, the trial court must commence trial on the Monday following the first anniversary that an order is entered naming the department as a temporary managing conservator. Next, we look at retaining the case on the docket, which is under 263-401B. And in order for the court to retain the case on the docket, the court has to find extraordinary circumstances to continue the department being named as temporary managing conservator. And it also says the court shall render an order setting out three things. First, a new automatic dismissal date. Second, further temporary orders for the safety and welfare of the child as necessary to avoid further delay. And three, a new trial date. In 2017, the legislature amended this provision and made it an automatic dismissal. No longer is a party required to raise this issue at trial or to file a pleading to dismiss it. It is automatically dismissed without court order. In determining whether the trial court retained jurisdiction, we look at the definition of rendition. Rendition is defined as the pronouncement of the judge's ruling, and that can be orally in the presence of a court reporter, or it can be in writing. So the first thing I want us to consider is whether we have an oral ruling in this case, and we do not. We do not have a transcript. The record is completely void of any oral ruling.
Do we not have, though, a docket entry that specifically moves the deadline?
Your Honor, in regards to the docket entry, I urge you to consider that is not a docket entry, and I also urge that you not consider that document for several reasons. First, it was not made available to the parties at the time of trial, nor was it made available to any of the appellate counsel at the time of briefing. It was not included in the clerk's record, the first supplemental, or the second supplemental. It was referred to by the state in their brief without the clerk's record citation. It was then added later on August 9th, and I'm asking you that you not consider it. It's been added to the clerk's record.
Well, you understand that the Family Code does allow orders, certain orders, to be made by docket entry. It's unique in terms of the ability. Ordinarily, docket entries cannot be considered with regard to part of the record. So are you arguing that this is or is not an actual docket entry? Because it doesn't appear on the official green docket that we get, which is why we had the issues that we did about supplementation of the record. But is there any authority that you've looked at that says whether or not we should consider this to be a docket entry or not?
Well, I have no authority for what exactly a docket entry is. The only thing I can look at is a docket entry in the clerk's record. And then we have these notes, and they look vastly different on their face. Also, a docket entry is to help define words. It's mainly for a memo for the clerk, for the judge. It's not to make the order. And if we're going to take the argument that the state is urging you that it is an order, I ask you then to refer back to 263-401B and see whether it has those three requirements, and it does not. Because the docket or the notes just say that the extension's granted and it's reset on or before 4/30/19. It doesn't set forth a new trial date, it doesn't set forth a new dismissal date, and it doesn't include the further temporary orders.
Okay.
Similarly, the state is asking you to consider the permanency report filed by the department, and ask that you consider that that is an order retaining jurisdiction and extending the dismissal date, and argue that it is not. The permanency report is not a court's order. It's not signed by the judge. It's just something filed by the department. And in fact, it was filed on March 14, 2019, 10 days after the court lost jurisdiction over the case. It had already automatically dismissed. So I'm asking you that you can to consider the record. There's no order in place that extends this jurisdiction to this case and extends the dismissal date. The permanency report's not in order. The notes aren't in order. And there's nothing orally on the court's record extending the jurisdiction. Thank you.
Counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Joe Spence, here representing the department. Well, there's a lot to respond to, but let me just start with our first point about failure to preserve this error. As I was researching the cases, I came upon a concept, or actually some rulings, that said for a party to complain on appeal that the dismissal deadline was passed and that the case should have been dismissed, that party had to file a motion to dismiss with the trial court. And as I was looking at that, suddenly I realized that those cases were pre-September 1, 2017. Because, as counsel stated, 263-401 and 402 were amended in 2017, effective September 1, 2017. So I thought to myself, well, maybe those apply, and it's true. In 2017, the dismissal deadline became truly jurisdictional. There are cases before that that clearly say it was not jurisdictional. So then I went and looked at the enacting legislation, which we cite in our brief, as to when the effective date of these amendments were, and it said they were effective September 1, 2017. So I looked in the clerk's record, and I realized, and it says effective to suits filed on or after September 1. So I looked in the clerk's record, and I found that this suit was originally filed in June of 2017 before the effective date of the 2017 amendments. And so I thought, well, that suggests to me that the prior versions of 263-401, which was in 2015, and 263-402 was way back in 2007, I thought those must apply. And I still think that's the correct interpretation here, because what we have is the AG did file a suit affecting a parent-child relationship in June of 2017, and it is filed under a singular cause number, and that is still the cause number all the way through the order that's being appealed. There was a single cause number in a single case. I think what has been somewhat confusing, and after I got the letter brief yesterday from the appellants, it suddenly dawned on me probably what really the department's petition is a petition intervention. It's really not a separate suit. It really, and again, there's case law that says you don't really judge it by the title. You judge it by the relief being requested and what's actually happening. And I think it's a petition and intervention. And I think at that point under Rule 60, as you know, in Texas, civil procedure rule, parties have the fundamental right to intervene at any time without requesting leave. And conversely, the other side has the fundamental right at any time to move to strike it. So I think first and foremost, this argument that was raised yesterday for the first time by the appellants of this 155-001-D, all that provision says to me as I read it, is that if a court, usually a juvenile court, enters a final order over a child or a matter, it becomes the court of continuing exclusive jurisdiction. And then D says, until and unless that happens, any other proceedings should be filed as original proceedings. And I think that means as a separate lawsuit. But the point here is, that's not what happened. And again, the appellants never objected. And I think if they'd wanted to at that point, they could have filed a motion to strike the intervention. This 155-001-D could have been the basis to strike it and would have forced the department to go file under a separate cause number. But that didn't happen. And so our basic argument is simply that because this original suit was filed in June of 2017, the 2017 amendments did not apply. And the net effect of that, and the most important thing for preservation, is under the 2015 version and 2007 version of these two statutes, the statute specifically required a party who wants to complain of the failure to of the court's failure to dismiss once the one-year deadline had passed, had to file a motion to dismiss. And if they didn't, they do not preserve their complaint. And that's exactly what happened here. And the policy behind that is this idea that because it was not jurisdictional, if the one-year deadline passes, the court still had jurisdiction. And so the statute said, because it still has jurisdiction, if you want to get it dismissed, you have to file this motion to dismiss before commencement of trial on the merits. And that was the rule. And so as long as after the one-year deadline, but before commencement of trial on the merits, you stood up and said, I know under these prior versions, it's not jurisdictional, but I want you to dismiss it because we have gone past the one-year deadline. That's what you were required to do, and that didn't happen. So our first point in our brief is that simply all of the complaints that have been alleged in this case were not preserved because they all relate to this passage of this one-year deadline. And under the current version, I can't dispute that. Under the 2017 versions, the language of the statute, you know, 263-401A, just flat out says now it is jurisdictional and automatically terminated. And I think under those, I might be in trouble, except my second argument, which is the argument that I think based on this record, this court can find that the one-year deadline was in fact extended.
Okay. Let me break you up here a little bit. Okay. So basically, we understand your argument to be that because the savings clause in the enacting language specifically saves with regard to any pending SAPSR, okay? So, and the termination action that was filed, the paternity action falls within the general definition of a SAPSR because that was an active action in the 233rd that, even though it was brought by the AG, totally different jurisdictional basis for doing so, and the petition that was then filed by the department, not by the AG, but by a totally different governmental entity, mentions completely different jurisdictional language, has to be, in fact, served anew, okay, to meet due process provisions, etc. So every aspect of it is a new aspect of litigation. You're saying simply because it got filed in the same action, which never actually came to a final conclusion, that you get the state gets the benefit, if you will, the benefit of the old law being extended because of that savings clause.
And two things, Your Honor, I'll work backwards. As to all of the effects of the things that may have had to have happened, service, et cetera, again, my position is all of that would have been a ground to strike the petition for intervention that said, Department, you can't come into this party. You got to serve these things. This is a whole different animal. Strike this intervention. Secondly, I think that it's important to note that the AG's petition wasn't purely a parentage petition. In fact, they stated jurisdiction in that petition under Chapter 231, Chapter 153 of the Family Code, Chapter 160 of the Family Code, 158 of the Family Code, all of which are remedies available under Title V of the Family Code. And the definition of suit affecting parent-child relationship that's found in 101.032 specifically says that it's a suit brought under Title V, and every one of the three types of things are the types of things that are in the AG's petition. So I think this idea that we're kind of labeling it as just this, or as Pellant wants to, this sort of parentage action only that's so dissimilar to any of the issues.
Was there any relief granted by the court based upon the AG's petition?
I'm not sure as I stand here. I think there was some parentage things that, and again, I remember a concession or somebody came to the, and now whether that was an affirmative order or not, I don't know. And I don't dispute their position that no court here became until the final order, if it is a final order.
Okay.
Yeah.
With regard to if we conclude that this is a new SAPS or an original proceeding and 155.001 does in fact apply, okay, then we get to the point of whether or not you can invoke the docket entry as the order from the earlier entry. And what it appears, based upon the supplemental record, is that we're not actually dealing with the actual docket, the green sheet docket. What we're dealing with is a case management notation. And just to say that the case law is all over the place with regard to whether or not you can consider a case management notation, whether it falls within the definition of a docket entry under the family code, or whether it actually falls within the definition of the docket under the rules of appellate procedure that's part of the record. Do you have any authority that we need to pay attention to with regard to whether or not a case management entry can fall under either the family code definition of a docket entry or under the traps with regard to that?
I don't have any authority on the basis if we assume it is a management control document. I'm not sure it's not a docket sheet. This was the docket sheet on the clerk's record. It's two little entries, and we all remember these when trial judges kept them inside of the current file folder, and they would write entries. This is not in the record, and I'm not pretending that it is, but what happened here, I'll just go on. But
the way we see it is you've requested the record to be presented.
Yes.
You can only request a record that's allowed pursuant to the traps, okay? So it's got to fall within some aspect of the rules of appellate procedure for it to be a part of the record that we may consider. So since you're asking us to consider it, that's what I'm asking for, is what's your authority for us to be able to consider it?
I understand. My authority would start with, I believe it's 34.6 or 5 of the rules of what's automatically included in a clerk's record. One of them says docket sheet. If you turn back in the rules of civil procedure, I think it's rule 28, 29, and 30, right in that range, they talk about the clerk's docket, and then they talk about the court's docket. And those are things that are specifically identified under the rules of civil procedure. And what I think is happening here is that we are at a crossroads between old school and new school electronics. It was stunning to me when I saw this docket that there's nothing written on it. There's no entries. And then what we were led to believe, and again, this is not part of the record, but my investigation was, is the judges are now keeping electronic dockets. It's the judge's docket. It's not the clerk's docket. And the judge's docket, I think, is what has traditionally been included in a clerk's record.
I think the family code provision with regard to the docket entry being an order that's appealable and effective in terms of rendition stems from like 1995. Now, there were case management systems at that point in time, but nothing, that's even before the Supreme Court's order making sure all the electronic filing and stuff has to happen.
I agree with that. But where I got to this is as a side door, if you will, to what you just said, was when I looked at 263.401 and B, it said the exception to this one-year deadline said it can be extended. And 263.402 says if the court renders an order, and I thought that was interesting, renders, because you know that's a term that we bounce around between rendition and it surprised me even further then when I went to Family Code 101026 under the definitions, render is actually defined. 101026 is entitled render. And it says render means, and it says the pronouncement, it's a pronouncement by the judge. It can be made orally in the presence of a court reporter, as my fellow counsel mentioned. It can be mentioned in writing, but what my opposing counsel didn't mention is right after that it says including on the court's docket sheet. And that's what led me to think because, as you know, trial counsel, and this stems back to when I read the record and found that exchange on volume 2 of the reporter's record at page 10, where the department's counsel stood up in front of everybody and said, Judge, we had a hearing before this. It wasn't memorialized into a written order, but the deadline was extended, and here's my order, which is a March 26 order, and here's my order, so we won't have any jurisdictional issues, etc. In all counsels, the judge asked everybody, do you have any objection to that? No, Your Honor, do you have any objection? Everybody sat silent and had no objection. And it's not just that they didn't object, but they didn't object in the face of the very representation that the department's trial counsel was making, that, Judge, we had a hearing and this was extended, and here's my order memorializing it. Now, again, whether that's enough, I don't know. I think it is, because I think it's not only that March 26th written order that was signed by the judge at that moment, based on the representations made by department's counsel in front of all counsel and the judge, and their silence, not only silence, their affirmative statement, I have no objections. And you couple that back to the docket sheet entry, and I believe it is a docket sheet, and I think I put in my brief, if there's some, I'm not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes, if there's something that the court wants to remand it back to the trial court and have the judges hold a hearing on what those sheets mean and are, I'm okay with any of that. Again, I'm not trying to trick anybody. But that's why I believe, and counsel says that we cited this permanency report. We didn't cite it as it was an order. I'm citing it because in there, there's a reference made by the department that says, oh, by the way, this case, the one-year dismissal deadline was extended to August 30, which is exactly the same date in the order that was signed 2 weeks later.
There's a small problem with that, and that is that your case management or docket sheet entry doesn't say August. It says April.
Well, that's the trial.
So.
Right. I agree with that. And the docket entry refers to trial on or before April, whatever. You're right. It did not say extended. And that then raises the question of, number one, nobody on this appeal has raised an objection to that. They didn't raise an objection in front of the trial judge when he showed them the order that had that date in there. They haven't raised that as an objection here. There's only one objection to the substance of that order that was ultimately signed, and that was made by the father, which talks about one of the requirements is there has to be any necessary temporary orders as necessary. And, of course, our position here is when that order was signed, you didn't need to have that because the trial was occurring. There weren't any requirement for further necessary orders pending a trial. So, again, I just, that's why I pointed all that out, is it seems to me in this case that the order that was ultimately signed, it was never objected to, and nobody had any problems with any of this. And the counsel's reference that there was a hearing, there's a docket entry, I believe that is a docket sheet. I think if you read it, it reads just like a docket sheet, but again, so.
All right, counsel, thank you.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Thank you.
Counsel.
I want to address a few points that the department has made in their argument. The department has essentially asked this court to authorize gamesmanship, to give them the ability to call something an intervention, enter a case in order to select the law that will apply and help the department in their suit to terminate. That would be the effect of their argument to allow them to call it a petition, an intervention. They can go online, they can figure out the cause number, they can file into that. If nobody objects, they can set the law in direct contravention of the legislative intent. That is the argument that they have made with regard to that. With regard to the
But counsel,
yes.
To be fair,
that's the effect.
Three of the kids were before the 231st.
Absolutely.
Okay. It's not like you could go someplace else and file something in any other court because there was an active lawsuit involving jurisdiction over those three kids in that court. So how is the department going to file something in another court when in fact there's active litigation?
Well, they would have two options. They could call it an original petition. They could get their new cause number under 155001D if the law helped them on September 1st. And if the law did not help them, they could have called an intervention and file into an existing lawsuit. It's not going to apply to every suit. It's not going to apply to every child before a court or a petition regarding the department, but it can apply. This could be an offensive gamesmanship tactic that the department could employ to ensure that their outcomes
but
are more...
But you're dramatic. Asking us to believe that the department would do it as a matter of gamesmanship, anticipating that they would not actually get done what they needed to get done with regard to the extension.
I understand that, but the ruling would be more expansive than just these statutes, because the legislature meets every 2 years, and as such, these statutes are subject to change. For instance, about 2 years ago, the Texas legislature added an affirmative defense under 161.001 subsection D that only applies to terminations under subsection O grounds, failure to comply with the service plan. Conceivably, this argument could be applied to say that if they file into an ongoing case, that affirmative defense would be null and void because it didn't exist at the time of filing.
But the only reason they've got that argument is because the actual language in the enacting, the savings language, didn't say this applies to, even though it only applied to termination actions, didn't say this applies to newly filed termination actions. It said any SAPSR.
That's correct. It was inartful. But I will note that under 263.401A specifically, the term suit affecting the parent-child relationship is used two times. One to refer to what we traditionally think is a suit affecting the parent-child relationship, another time to refer to a suit affecting the parent-child relationship where termination is sought. So that term is used within the context of 263.401 a little bit different than the overall family code.
Okay.
Additionally, I do want to address the docket entry. I don't think this qualifies as a docket sheet. This docket sheet was not made available to the public until August 8th of 2019. If there had been an allegation that this was lost or destroyed, the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure provide a very specific course of conduct that the appellee could have engaged in to get this reviewed. They could have filed the appropriate motion with this court or the trial court. I think it's 34.5 subsection E. They could have alleged that this was not included because it was lost or destroyed. This document appears to have appeared out of nowhere. After they filed their brief, I did attempt to get a copy. The district clerk informed me they didn't have one. After this court sent a letter on August 7th requesting that it be made part of the record, I attempted to get a copy. The district clerk again told me they didn't have one.
Let me ask you this. If let's assume that this wasn't in the form of a docket entry. Let's assume that Judge DeVos made this entry in the form of a formal written order. Are the other provisions 1, 2, and 3 of 263.401B waivable without objection to the form of the order?
So you're asking what if they fail to set a new dismissal date or if they fail to set a trial date?
And nobody said anything about it.
I don't think they're waivable because the way it ties into subject matter jurisdiction, the changes that were made to subsection 402, or excuse me, section 402 and 401 are clear that the Texas legislature considered the previous case law and wanted to remove the waiver provisions. This is no longer waivable. In order to get an extension, there are very specific findings that must be made, and there's very specific provisions that must be included. Without extending the dismissal date, I think the automatic dismissal date would occur, pass, and the court would lose subject matter jurisdiction. Without setting a new trial date within that time period, I think you'd run into the same issue. I think with regard to the further temporary orders provision, which is under subsection 2, there may be a little bit of leeway with a proper judicial finding that no further orders were necessary. Now I see the remainder of my time is gone. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, counsel. We thank you for your arguments. We will consider them and we... What?
Is she getting a rebuttal?
Oh, are you getting a rebuttal?
No.
No, okay. I thought y'all figured out who was going to do a rebuttal. He kicked me underneath the bench. Okay, argument has been had. We will consider it. We thank you very much for it. The case is now submitted, and so y'all can go hint.